I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Bernard Madoff says he's sorry. Jobless claims hit a record high. We'll keep an eye on these stories, but we start today with a conversation about overseas adoptions. What would you do if you were told that the child you'd adopted from, say, India, was actually a kidnap victim? Journalist Scott Carney delivered that message to a family in the Midwest after seeing evidence that the child had been snatched, sold to an Indian orphanage, then placed with the Midwestern family through an American agency. We'll hear from another adoptive father in a few minutes, but first, Scott tells the story of the large number of overseas adoptions connected to kidnapping in Mother Jones magazine and joins us from Chennai, India. Scott, take us back. The parents you meet there say their son, Subhash, was taken almost 10 years ago now. Did anyone see that?
To our knowledge, no one saw it happen. I mean, these are also pretty crowded areas, and if it was just for a minute or two, it would be pretty easy to sneak off a child. And actually, there are at least dozens of cases just like this right across Chennai. I've talked to personally four parents who've had just the same story happen.
Did Subhash's parents try to find him? What did they do?
They spent about 5 years looking for Subhash. Nageshwar Rao and Sivagama, his parents, scoured the entire state of Tamil Nadu by hiring friends and relatives, and they basically bankrupted their family to finance these investigations, and really nothing came of it. But at the time, for at least 2 years, Subhash was just living maybe only 10 kilometers away in an orphanage on the north side of the city.
Well, as his family tumbles from middle class to poverty, pulls their daughter out of school to save money, and then they trace him to this orphanage because of a break the police had in the case in 2005. What happened?
The story that's told is that there were a couple people arguing in a bar saying what lousy prices they were getting for kidnapping children. And the story filtered down to the local police station. Cops came and arrested the two people. From there, the story spiraled out that they were working for an orphanage called Malaysian Social Services and kidnapping children right off the streets and giving them to the orphanage that would later basically sell the children to adoption agencies in America.
Well, and here's where money first enters the storyline, because the Malaysian Social Services orphanage that sends children overseas from India pays people for surrendering children. It's not a lot, but it would seem like that's an incentive for kidnapping them.
See, there are two stories here. When I spoke to Dinesh Ravindranath, who runs Malaysian Social Services, he told me that he was paying $50 to $75 to women who came to him to give up their babies. And he said, you know, I know it's illegal to do this, but we have to give these women something. But when you talk to the police, and if you look at the records around it, he was actually employing people to kidnap children. It wasn't this sort of absent-minded, oh, I didn't check all the records sort of thing. What the police are saying is that he just said, hey, to his gardener, go and collect me a couple children. We need some more kids for our adoption stream.
Well, and the records show that the owner paid far more than $50 to the people who confessed to kidnapping. Now, that owner is still running children's programs, but the orphanage part of his business has been shut down. It's under investigation. Meanwhile, what is your sense of how seriously the Indian police took these allegations of kidnapping? Did they help the parents initially?
No. I mean, we're looking at about 164 cases of international adoptions that were suspicious through Malaysian Social Services. And a lot of these parents went to the police, and the police just ignored them. The only reason that Nageshwar Rao and two other cases were followed up on is because these people got lawyers who were willing to take their cases for free. And those lawyers then pursued it for 5 years before they got anywhere. The case was shuttled around from state bureaus to the local bureaus, and then finally to the federal branches, which is the equivalent of the FBI here. And, you know, the cases were whittled down from 164 cases to only three cases that the police are currently pursuing.
Well, let's talk about what other proof there might be that Subhash, the disappeared toddler, went through this orphanage to a family in the Midwest. You mentioned the former gardener at the orphanage. He confessed to grabbing Subhash. And then you have records from the orphanage that show that they admitted a boy about the same age the next day, the day after he disappeared. And then there are these surrender deeds. Explain what these are.
Well, a surrender deed is the first document that generates a sort of an adoption record or an orphanage record for any child, which is basically an affidavit signed by a mother saying, I can no longer care for my child. I relinquish any claim I have on him. But these deeds, and I've seen several of them, are just fabrications. I mean, the stories are pretty much the same. They're taken in front of a notary and signed. But the police allege that the signatures on these aren't even by women. They were signed by men. And then when Nageshwar Rao was called to the police department, the police actually showed a photo of his son and asked him, is this him? And it was from the adoption records of MSS. And Nageshwar Rao positively identified his son.
And you show in Mother Jones, Subhash's parents also holding photos of him. So police could definitely match the pictures that they had of him with the pictures of the child that was in the orphanage. Well, now, how did the police track Subhash to the family in the Midwest that you ended up visiting as well?
The child's name, who was Subhash, whose name was changed to Ashraf, which is a Muslim name. Then what they did is they followed, they just picked up his adoption record, and the address was right there on the adoption record. I was able to collect those records, and you know, it's just sort of a straight line to this house on the banks of Lake Michigan.
As you're leaving India to go meet with that family, you tell, we'll call him Subhash, you tell Subhash's father you're going. This is a very poignant moment. The father doesn't speak English, but he says to you what? He expresses to you what?
He points sort of out into the, you know, what I assume is America, and he says, family, and then he points to himself, friends, to say that he wants to be friends with his family in America because he doesn't hold them accountable for what these criminals were doing. He wants to forge a relationship with them. You know, after 10 years living in the United States, he realizes that his son is culturally American at this point, but he wants to be part of his life. He doesn't want for his son to think that he was just abandoned, but that he has real parents who love him in India.
And in fact, his mother seems a shell of herself.
Yeah, she was actually briefly put into a mental institution because just the stress around this was just too much for her. She is in dark circles under her eyes, and she cries at the name of Subhash.
So you leave one pair of brokenhearted parents, but you're about to create another because you travel to the U.S. from India to find Subhash, and you do. You pull up to his street and you see him, 10 years older, but there he is. This is quite a heart-thumping moment for you. Do you have any hesitation about, you know, knocking on that door with the news you were bringing?
I had no idea what I was doing at that point. I had this plan in my head that they would see the evidence and say, oh my God, this is, you know, so horrible, and what are we going to do? But I was sitting in the car, and I just realized that it was going to be so much more difficult than I could ever imagine. And with the child I was looking for just playing on a swing set, I realized that I couldn't just go up to their parents and say, oh, your children was actually kidnapped. It was just one of the hardest things I've ever done.
But you do it. You speak to them, not with the child there, obviously. And what do they say?
Actually, there were two meetings. The first meeting, I just gave them the packet of information that I'd had, just the evidence to look it over, because it was such a shocking thing. And when the father pulled up in a car, he actually was so nervous about it that he sort of was laughing. He was like, I think I know why you're here, he said. Apparently he had read news reports about Malaysian social services in Chennai after Googling it. And he had an idea that this was a possibility. And then he took the file and he drove off. And then the next day I met with them a second time in a park near their house. And they were terribly broken up that this was a possibility. Yet at the same time, they didn't believe it either. And they wanted more evidence. And yet they were not inclined to sort of give me any evidence or even contact the lawyers in Chennai or the police department. It was very difficult.
Well, and you also go to the American agency through which they adopted their child. And as you write, the woman there was not happy to make your acquaintance at all. She also had followed adoption scandals in the Indian press, but said that the Indian government signed off on every case her agency brokered. And when you asked her why, she never contacted the family to warn them that there may have been a kidnapped child since she was following the news in India. She didn't comment. What was your sense of the agency's knowledge of what's going on?
Well, at the point of writing the article, I wanted to give them the benefit of the doubt. Maybe they just didn't know anything about it, and they're just trying to cover their tracks and do really good things by arranging adoptions and getting children to America. But since writing the article, I've been reading up on more documents, more cases, and I've actually found them, this same agency, attached to at least two other suspicious adoptions. There's enough evidence for me to think that if this agency didn't know what was happening, they were certainly looking the other way, and they made no effort to contact the families that had these children who were kidnapped. And so at the time of publishing the article, we had decided to not publish the agency's name. But at this point, I think that it's the duty of the state to investigate it further. And its name is Paquette Adoption Services in Portage, Wisconsin.
Well, and you've talked to people who've become advocates for families who adopt from overseas. One is Beth Peterson, who runs iChild. That's a support website for families adopted from India. And she worked for the U.S. government helping families with international adoptions. And she's come to believe that, in fact, Indian orphanages have become, you know, de facto businesses engaging in criminal activity. And others told you that as long as there is the fee structure that there is, that Americans are willing to pay so much, and that so much money is changing hands for children, this is going to be the case, that children are going to be kidnapped.
There's no doubt about it. And you know, the first question that comes into anyone's mind is, with, if there's so many orphans available in Indian orphanages, I mean, they're packed, you know, three children to a crib is not uncommon. If there's so many children, why would you go about kidnapping in the first place? But the problem is that American families and Western families want healthy, cute children. And those children don't emerge from crowded cribs. You only get those children if you actually go out and pick them off the streets. So not only is adoption not helping orphans in India, it's not helping the families who have their children taken. And the profit motive is absolutely enormous. A typical adoption in India, it costs $14,000 to $15,000 plus an adoption fee of $3,500. And then you pay your airfare and those things too. I mean, this is big money in India. I mean, the per capita income in India, I believe, is around $200. I mean, just, it's unimaginable amounts of cash. And if you can get a child kidnapped by paying only $200 or $300, what incentive do they have not to kidnap children? If adoptions were free, you know, if you could just say, I'd like to adopt a child and there was no money involved, what incentive would they have to kidnap a child? In fact, the whole system could be made incredibly equitable if governments ran these orphanages, didn't charge fees, and, you know, increase their oversight of these orphanages. I mean, it's possible to do good adoptions, but that's just not what happens. I want to underscore that this is not only a problem in India. In Nepal, 97% of adoptions are sent out of the country. It led Sarah Crowe of UNICEF to call the orphanage business, the adoption business, just a child clearinghouse.
That's Scott Carney in Chennai, India. We'll link you to his report on overseas adoptions in Mother Jones Magazine at our website, hereandnow.org. Scott, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, when we come back, a father whose adopted daughters were also snatched goes to India to find their birth mother, and later stay or go if you're in the path of a California wildfire. After a break, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide. On the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We just heard the story of a child kidnapped in India and adopted in America by parents who just couldn't bear to accept the truth. Well, our next guest made a different decision. David Smolin is a professor of law at Samford University in Alabama. He and his wife adopted two Indian children, 10 and 12, who told them they weren't orphans. David found out their mother had brought them to an orphanage for an education, very common in India, but was either tricked or forced into giving them up and tried and failed to get them back. David Smolin joins us. And David, start at the beginning. How did you find out your girls weren't orphans?
When they came, they told the lies that they'd been coached to tell. We found out through their best friend who had been adopted to another family here in the U.S. about this other story, this story of their mom being forced to give them up. This was pretty early in, about 6 weeks. The girls didn't speak much English yet, but we managed to communicate to them that we had heard this other story, very different from the story of their father being dead and their mom making a voluntary choice. What happened then was very, very critical and really quite sad. The girls told us that, yes, that was true, but then they also told us they really didn't know. They didn't know for 100% sure whether their mother had made a choice, whether she'd been forced, whether they'd been sold. And they were, in fact, absolutely tormented by this question.
Well, so to try to get answers, you appeal to your American Adoption Agency for help, but they tell you there's no need for the girls to know. You were also told you could put the birth mother in danger if you yourself went to find her in India. You search around and ultimately find an activist who travels to the mother's village in India and determines that the story of her wanting the girls is true. And you make the extraordinary decision to open up the adoption. You take your daughters to India. What was that like? Because at this point, they must have been very Americanized.
They are very Americanized, and even though we urged them to keep up their original language, they had pretty well lost the capacity to say a whole lot in it. I took them one at a time. They were young women at that point, and so really it was a very different situation than with the younger children, because our own position was that they are young adults. There's not going to be any kind of custody fight. The initial reunion was very, very emotional. The mother wept and wept and wept. The mother explaining to the daughter, you know, she hadn't meant to do this. This is what happened. The daughter telling the mom, you know, we had a really hard time. We never wanted to leave you. I explaining we never wanted to take children from a mom who wanted them. The mom wanted them to stay. The girls didn't want to stay. And really, it was a very, very good thing for the girls, because they'd been tortured by this question of what had happened, and seeing their mother and seeing that she did love them has really helped them move forward in life. But for the mother, it's doubly sad, because she has them back, and it's better that she knows that they're okay, but she doesn't really have them back.
Right.
They become different people.
Well, David, what's it like for you as an adoptive parent now? I'm guessing maybe it was a little easier because you didn't have these girls from, you know, birth, from, you know, from 1 year old. They were a little older when they came into your life, but still, you're their adoptive parent. What was that like for you to see this other parent? I mean, was there a fear of losing them? Was there a feeling of guilt? I mean, what's it like for you?
There is a tremendous sense of guilt. We do keep up with the family over there, and we try to make sure that the next generation gets a good quality education, in part for their sake, in part so there'll be a kind of a bridge generation that can speak both English and the native language and can serve as a bridge. But for us, we had been, and especially my wife, Desiree, had been tortured by the idea that there was a mother over in India who had not made this choice, but in fact had had her children taken from her. And so it was actually, for us, the best thing we ever did in the whole adoption, finding the family.
Can you understand, though, that there are parents who may have had adopted children from their birth, and they're now 10, 11, and they don't have the memory that your girls had of another parent? And for these American adoptive parents, you know, it's gut-wrenching. They don't want to do what you did, which is reach back to the birth parents left behind.
I can certainly understand the fear. I've had contact with some of these parents. I blame the adoption agencies and the U.S. government for essentially doing nothing in these situations.
Well, what do you think should be done?
U.S. agencies should be held accountable for their partners in other countries. There ought to be a way made to share the child in some manner analogous to an open adoption with the other family. I personally think that if it's only been a year or so, the child should be returned. The adoption community, the two governments need to work together to lessen to make adoptive families feel safe. Instead, adoptive families are made to feel that they're basically on their own.
And you say two countries, but of course, this is happening in China, Cambodia. It's not just India.
Whichever the sending country
right.
is.
That's David Smolin. He teaches at the Cumberland School of Law at Stanford University and is the adoptive parent of two girls from India. And together they discovered there was a birth family missing those girls back in India. David, one last thought. What would you say to adoptive parents right now who are listening to this in their hearts and their throat?
First of of all, I would say that I've written, as a law professor now, a number of articles about this problem. So you can just Google David Smolin and BE Press. You can read those articles. I would certainly welcome contacts, because the likelihood of this varies a great deal based on the country you adopted from, the particular part of that country. You can look into these things and determine how likely it is. Secondly, adoptive parents need to, and also prospective adoptive parents, hold their U.S. agencies accountable. Rather than just wanting a baby at all costs and believing whatever the agency tells you, you've got to take responsibility before you adopt or after you adopt to make sure that the agencies are very, very careful about who they link up with and about the monetary incentives that are provided in the other country, because the money's the problem.
David Smolin, will link our listeners to you at our website, hearandnow.org. Thank you so much.
Sure.
And still to come, when a TV show breaks through product placement, after the news, Here and Now. One of the iconic symbols of the American West, the gray wolf, may once again be either a target or back in court. The Obama administration announced this month that it will let stand a Bush administration proposal to remove the gray wolf from the endangered species list in large parts of the Rocky Mountains and western Great Lakes regions. Ranchers are thrilled, but environmental groups are consulting lawyers. Bill Schneider is an editor for the Missoula, Montana-based online journal NewWest.net. And Bill, we spoke right after the New Year, and you told us the question of what to do about the gray wolf would be the hottest political issue in the West this year. You said the word passion is an understatement to describe how Westerners feel about the gray wolf from both sides. So remind us, why does it stir such emotions?
Well, the wolf has become kind of an agent of cultural change out here in the West, an image of the federal government coming in and taking over or having more influence on people out here than they really would like to have.
It's a states' rights issue.
It's more of that than a wildlife issue, actually.
And what is the wildlife issue? Ranchers, we know, complain that wolves kill livestock.
Wolves kill livestock. I mean, nobody disputes that. It's whether that is a serious enough problem to prevent us from having a viable wolf population or not.
And environmentalists, meanwhile, say that reestablishing the wolf is essential to restore biodiversity?
Yes, it is. We've been without the master predator, kind of the top of the food chain, in the West for many decades. And now the wolf has reestablished, and so you have more of a complete ecosystem.
Right. Well, let's remind ourselves of the history. After all but disappearing from the continental U.S., the gray wolf was put on the endangered list in 1974, but then reintroduction programs began in the late 1990s. So how successful were they?
You could say too successful. The wolf expanded its numbers a lot faster than anybody really thought it would, even the backers of the reintroduction in the first place. Now we're looking at, in the Rocky Mountain region, about somewhere between 1,500 and 2,000 wolves, which was roughly twice as many as the promoters of the reintroduction thought we'd have at this point.
Well, and that's the thinking behind the Obama administration and new U.S. Interior Secretary Ken Salazar's decision to take the wolf off the endangered species list. Salazar says this is one of the great success stories of the Endangered Species Act. And what exactly does it mean for wolves? They're going to come under state management in what states?
The order that he reissued would cover all states in the continental United States, the Great Lakes states and the Rocky Mountain states. But an important point there, Robin, is that even though he's proposed delisting, basically using almost the same plan as the Bush administration, that will definitely be challenged in court.
It's not a fait accompli, and we should add that in Wyoming, the Obama administration is saying that gray wolves will remain on the endangered species list. Why?
Wyoming has been very uncooperative and stubborn in having its own way and not publishing a acceptable state management plan, and that has left them sort of out of this current delisting plan. That will be one of the points that will come out in the litigation, because it's hard scientifically to delist or manage wildlife populations based on state boundaries, because wildlife obviously doesn't know where the state boundary is.
Right. So this is to be continued, but the headline in your column in today's edition of New West reads, Wolf Delisting, the Never-Ending Story. And I was wondering if that referred to, you know, the inability to find a middle ground for both sides on the issue, or does that refer, you know, to the wolves and their on and off again endangered status? Do you think that if court appeals don't work and they are delisted in the fall, that they will once again end up on the endangered species list?
No, I don't think so. I think the states are very capable of managing as well as having a viable population going on for many decades into the future. There will be wolf hunting seasons, but there's hunting seasons for many other species of wildlife. And in those cases, in many cases, actually, it's a wildlife numbers that are as high as they ever have been.
And the states are pledging to make sure that there is a certain number of wolves in their states. That's Bill Schneider, editor at the Missoula, Montana-based online journal NewWest.net. Bill, thanks so much, and why do I think we're going to talk about this again?
Because it's a never-ending story.
That's right, as you said. Thanks, Bill.
Thanks for having me.
Well, as always, we'd love to hear your thoughts. Go to hereandnow.org, comment, or click Contact Us. Here and Now. Signs of drought are everywhere. In central Texas, some ranchers are selling off cows because pastures are too dry to feed them. In South Florida, the water level in Lake Okeechobee is about 2 feet below average. And so far this year, the National Interagency Fire Center in Idaho has recorded more than 11,000 wildfires, almost 3,700 more than average. Well, the height of fire season in Southern California used to be August and September, but they're already in a drought-induced state of emergency. And our next guest says after 3 years of below-average rain and snowfall, it's fire season all year round. And after those deadly wildfires in Australia last month, he and other officials are revisiting how residents of California should react to a wildfire. Cliff Hunter is fire marshal in Rancho Santa Fe near San Diego. Cliff, welcome.
Thank you.
And to those awful fires in Australia, you know, we know 10,000 people displaced, 2,000 homes destroyed, at least 210 people killed, and killed in large part because of a policy, a version of which California was considering before the Australia wildfires. Let's talk about that version in Australia. It's called Stay and Defend. What does that mean?
Well, Stay and Defend means for Australia that they will get mop buckets, fill their bathtubs with water and their kitchen sinks with water, and an oncoming fire approaches, they'll go out and they'll try to fight the fire with those type of tools to make sure the fire doesn't communicate to their house.
In part, it's to put out burning embers, you know, to,
yes,
so it doesn't build. But they also then have to, you know, literally fight the fire because this is very rural. They're very far, often away from firefighters.
Yes, they do. And here in Southern California, we have similar conditions we call shelter in place versus not stay and defend. And the goal would be the people to evacuate here in California early. In Australia, when they're saying stay and defend, the question comes to hand, is it a defendable situation?
Right. Well, for people who don't understand, you know, thankfully, we don't know what it's like to have a wall of fire come at us. Why was it so hard for these poor people to ultimately get out when it was indefensible?
Well, part of it was timing. They don't have a very good notification system for the people in Australia. Here in Southern California, we have what's called reverse 911. So by use of a phone or a cell phone or a computer, we can notify people that they need to evacuate because of an oncoming wildland fire. That's one problem. I heard some information from Australia from a friend that's over there now, and he said people were given, you got about an hour and you might need to get out or stay and defend, and 3 minutes later the fire was on them.
Right. And it's too late to evacuate and you can't defend. And, you know, we're hearing these stories. You know, people don't understand that when you do decide to leave, even if there's maybe enough time ahead of the flames, you can't see anything. We hear cars were crashing into each other and crashing into fallen trees because they had no visibility. People ran out to start their cars, and we're learning that, you know, when there's a wall of flame that comes, if it's that big, it sucks the oxygen out of the car. You can't start the car.
That is correct. And we've even had fire engines on wildland fires that died because there was a lack of oxygen in the area at the time.
Oh, just terrible. Now, we understand in California, as you said, there's the shelter-in-place,
yes,
policy, and there was much more enthusiasm for it before the Australia fires. Have I got that right?
That's correct.
Yeah. So what's the thinking now?
Well, what our shelter-in-place communities are designed as is If you can't evacuate, you shelter in place. So don't drive out on a road that's smoky, there's not enough oxygen, you can't see, there's downed trees or power lines. The goal is you can stay in your house, and the fire front usually will go by within 15 to 30 minutes.
But there's a key here. If you're going to shelter in place, doesn't the place have to have certain requirements like fireproof tiles?
Yes, it has to be defendable. And all the homes in that our shelter-in-place community, we have 2,400 of them currently, and they all have the same building standards. They have a Class A roof, a roof that doesn't burn. The homes are placed away from the top of slope, and we look at all the landscaping, because landscaping is vegetation and will contribute to the spread of a fire.
Does that, though, give people a sense of false security if they think, well, I've got a shelter-in-place rated house?
It could be, because they have to do their part, and their part is closing garage doors, windows, and taking combustible materials such as patio furniture away from their home. So if it were to catch fire, it doesn't become an exposure and catch their home on fire.
Yeah.
So, you know, you need a whole system to make it work. But where I fear is, how is the homeowner going to react to the wildland fire when it approaches? With the smoke, the heat, the embers, 60 to 80 mile an hour winds, they're hot, and there's embers in there, burning material that are hitting upon your body as you're standing outside, and the air is difficult to breathe, and your visibility is practically nil. The other part, if you don't have goggles, then your eyes collect debris, and you can't see. They start to irritate you a lot.
Yeah.
And so it's really, in the middle of the day, it's like nighttime.
Yeah. So again, very different in California, because in California, officials are going to encourage evacuation first. There will be shelter-in-place homes, but don't maybe get too relaxed because you have those. It sounds like you're encouraging people to evacuate promptly no matter what.
Evacuate early so they don't get caught in those conditions of smoky roadways, or they can't see, or visibility, or not enough oxygen.
Yeah. So what would be the conditions under which somebody would stay in shelter in place? It just doesn't sound, you know, like a good idea.
The conditions is, it say it's 2 a.m. in the morning, and suddenly you get a reverse call that says you should evacuate, and you open your front door and you can't breathe or see.
It's already there, yeah.
You're better to close the door, close your windows, make sure everything's tight, move your drapes back, and wait for that fire to blow through. Because your home and your landscaping are all part of the systems approach, we call it. Everything's in place. And if it's kept in order, then it's going to be a good situation for you.
Yeah. Cliff, one last question. We understand one of the tragedies in Australia is that a lot of people had moved out to these rural areas from the city, and they really didn't, you know, they were city folk, and they didn't know anything about fires. We understand that happens in California as well, as people, you know, move out to more rural areas and really aren't part of the population that understands what happens. So what are the basics? I mean, what are the basics things you'd want people to understand about living out in the country that's vulnerable to fire?
Well, one of the things when you live out in the country when it comes to fire, you need to be self-reliant. You need to have the ability to take care of yourself. You need to understand that you have a responsibility to go out and do your clearance or your fuel modification of the vegetation that's too close to your house. You need to have the ability to harden your house a little bit, maybe with dual pane windows and doing a Class A roof. Those are the things that you would want to make sure you have a water supply. Out there in the backcountry, a lot of people work off of wells, and wells have a limited water supply. So you have tanks, and those tanks would give you some viable water to help fight fire. And the biggest thing in the backcountry is when a wildfire comes through, you usually lose all your power. So you need to have a backup power system if you want to stay out there and survive through a wildland fire.
See what you're doing. Also, you've told us two ways in, two ways out.
Yes, we always want to, in all of our communities in California, or at least in Southern California, we want to have two ways in, two ways out. Some of my larger communities that are 500 or 600 homes, we have three ways and four ways in and out. So the more makes it a little bit better. And it's not only for wildfire. It can be for any other type of natural disaster that may come along.
Okay. Cliff, thanks so much. And best to you during this really dry season out there in California.
Thank you very much.
Welcome back.
Musical legends, poets, artists, and revolutionaries once walked these streets. But today, these streets belong to us. For this group of friends, career success is at the top of the agenda.
And so is their Listerine, their Zyrtec allergy medicine, and their Ambi skin care products. That's the trailer for the new BET series, Harlem Heights, and it is taking product placement to new heights. The reality series about a group of African-American friends in New York has an extensive partnership with Johnson & Johnson. Is the bad economy forcing more product placement? Well, here now, media analyst and Boston University mass communication professor John Carroll joins us to take a look at that. And John, product placement has been going on forever. What is, for you, unusual about the BET deal with Johnson & Johnson?
Well, there's a couple of things unusual about BET. For once, they're a little bit late to the party. They haven't really done this because they haven't done this kind of programming so much. They're moving into more traditional entertainment content as opposed to the music videos that they had done before. What's also unusual is to do this in an unscripted reality show. It's a little bit harder to do.
Well, we understand one of the things that they did before the show is that they actually interviewed the people who were going to be on the show.
Right, and apparently some of them had allergies, so Zyrtec showed up. What they've done is tried to make this more of a partnership, less of a product placement deal, more of a partnership. So they run commercials on the show, and basically they're trying to move together with BET, almost in a co-production situation.
Right. It's really quite something. They found out what the young people used, and they've got it scattered all over the apartment. Should they use it? The camera catches it. And BET says one of the reasons they want to do it, there aren't a lot of commercials out there for African Americans.
It's true, and it's a neglected market, and I think it's also a market that has shown a lot of brand loyalty.
Well, so that's product placement in a reality show. But then there's also product integration. Campbell's Soup recently did this with daytime soaps. What did they do?
Well, they sort of turned it into a soup opera. What they did was they had Heart Healthy Month on the soap operas, and they integrated Campbell's Soup. And so people were talking about it. People were talking about how heart healthy it was. That goes beyond a can sitting on a counter. That works into the storyline itself.
Well, Gail Collins wrote about this in the New York Times. She writes, for some time, characters in daytime dramas have been taking time from their normal activities, like having amnesia, to engage in animated discussions about the sponsor's products. But this was quite something. Here's an exchange. One of the characters is about to go to the police station, and the other says, I have some soup for you. I don't want you to go to the police station on an empty stomach. What kind of soup is it? Says the other. It's Campbell's. It's healthy. Good for your heart. Yeah, it's good.
it's a whole new level and dimension of soap operas.
Well,
that
for
was
instance,
never
they're eating.
Before.
They're eating.
They're eating, which they normally don't do.
Don't do.
And they're taking care of each other, which they normally don't do.
Okay, so product integration there. Now, the new TNT series, Trust Me, really goes full bore. This is a show about ad executives. So, of course, it's a perfect vehicle for products. They have a deal with Dove. Here's a scene where a Dove executive is playing focus group videos for the ad agency. They're telling them what they want in their shampoo.
You know those commercials where they're running barefoot and their hair's blowing in the breeze? I mean, they're kind of silly. I just want my hair to look good.
Beauty realists. That's who's at the top of our pyramid.
Why not just take a camera into the ad agency of Dove?
Well, it's close to that. I'm pretty sure that was a real brand manager from Dove who was doing a cameo in the show. What they have is two levels of products appearing in Trust Me. One level is as badge products, just the way you and I would use them, just the way everybody uses them, to signify things, to communicate things. So one of the characters drinks Starbucks. Starbucks is not paying to be in the show, but he drinks Starbucks because he wants you to know that he's a Starbucks kind of guy. And then there are the other ones, which are just ads in sheep's clothing. Dove and I think Bertolli has a deal with them. GM has a deal with them, I believe. Basically, those are people who are paying to be in. But the difference is that in one case, they're using them to create images for characters. In the other, they're using them to make money. For shows to survive, this is becoming sort of an imperative for them to bring in this money. And a media executive said, basically, you don't tack marketing onto programs anymore. What you do is you start with the marketing and you build it into the DNA. And then you start to develop the program. Hmm. So they're looking at these as largely commercial vehicles for marketing purposes and less as entertainment content.
I mean, we've been saying this for years, but it really has happened. There are not that many people sitting there through commercial breaks.
Right, and I think that that's pushing advertisers to come up with ingenious and innovative new ways. I'm convinced that I'm not a scientist, but I'm convinced that they're going to come up with technology so that when you fast forward on your DVR through the commercial, it's going to show you a commercial in fast forward. It's going to be like a flip book. I'm convinced that they're going to develop this technology because there's no reason you can't shrink a 30-second spot right. when you're zipping through it down to a 7-second spot.
Well, we've talked here about how the NBC comedy 30 Rock with Tina Fey and Alec Baldwin sort of, mastered the art of flat out just talking about product placement. Are we doing our product placement now? But then it seems that you run into a problem because recently they had a whole episode about the McDonald's McFlurry ice cream, and everyone thought it was product placement. Let's listen.
These McFlurries are amazing.
I know. The soft swirl of vanilla and the hard crunch of candy and cookies. Do you think they fight each other? But no, together they are perfecto.
Some would say that describes us.
Selma Hayek there with Alec Baldwin. Now, afterwards, Tina Fey had to, you know, make a statement saying, no, I didn't get paid for this. This wasn't product placement. So it's a slippery slope.
It is, and McDonald's has to be thrilled, but there's been a tradition of mocking commercials and doing parodies of commercials. This continues it, but you've got this extra layer now where people sort of put it in a context of product placement as opposed to just being some kind of clever parody.
Yeah, like maybe you're not really mocking, maybe you're getting paid, which takes all the parody and strength out of it.
Right, and what it does is it sort of defuses that sort of postmodern, self-referential, insider joke thing, which 30 Rock does really well. And they're trying to, with a nod and a wink, say, we're selling out, but we're not really selling out. You know us. We don't really sell out.
It gets confusing.
There's a lot of mix and match going on. There's imaginary products out there, one on CBS's NCIS, this cola called Calf Pow that one of the characters drinks endlessly. And people now want to buy Calf Pow. And so there's some thought that somebody's going to start producing this stuff so that an imaginary product actually becomes a real product and then has product placement built in already.
Well, and John, what about the economy? Is that a factor here?
It's absolutely a factor. And shows are starting, this is starting to make the difference between extinction and survival for shows. Right now, at least one survey said that people don't mind, 2-1, they don't mind. But what's going to happen is the same as you have ad clutter in the commercial breaks, you're going to start having product placement clutter in shows. And all of a sudden, there's going to be this oversaturation that's going to produce a backlash. And if people start tuning out, then they're going to be in a worse situation than they were before. One final thing is the FCC is looking into some kind of regulation, this sort of old-fashioned idea that people have a right to know when they're being advertised to. And the FCC is saying maybe you should be flashing paid product placement on the screen while they're talking about Verizon or Snapple on 30 Rock. Producers are throwing up their hands in horror over that. But the FCC, especially under Democratic Congress, is basically looking at the possibility of being more transparent about this and giving people a better idea of what's going on the screen.
Here now, media analyst and Boston University professor John Carroll. John, would you mind handing me one of those Kleenex brand facial tissues?
Not at all, because you know why? They're soft and they're absorbent.
Aren't they? Thank you. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.